Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Snake Oilers edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Snake Oilers is a wholly sponsored podcast we do here at Risky.biz, where vendors come onto the show to pitch their wonderful, wonderful, magical snake oil to you, the listeners. And we basically do this with six vendors twice a year, and we split each edition into two parts. So you'll hear from three vendors today and from three vendors next week or the week after, something like that. So in today's podcast, you'll be hearing from MongoDB. Very interesting one, that, actually. AlphaSock and SecureStack. AlphaSock make a network traffic analytics engine, I guess, but they do some other more sophisticated stuff these days. You'll hear all about that. SecureStack make cloud security tools for developers and sort of, you know, managing resources, cloud resources for developers. But yeah, we're going to kick things off with our interview with Ken White from MongoDB. And MongoDB has released a new encryption feature that a bunch of you compliance-heavy folks out there are going to find really interesting and valuable. I'd imagine just some generally security-conscious people among you will find this interesting as well. So basically what they've done is they've built tools to allow you to encrypt sensitive fields in your databases. So if, you know, God forbid someone were to access your database somehow, they wouldn't be able to just, you know, dump the whole thing and get access to sensitive information. And sure, yeah, if someone can pop shell on your, like, you know, if this is hooked up to a web application, if someone pops your app server, yeah, they're still going to be able to access that information. But, you know, then you're in a position to actually introduce some extra controls, like query limits for certain things, you know. So it's a step forward. It's a meaningful step forward. So Ken White, he worked on this feature. He joined me to talk about it. And he started off by explaining, you know, why you don't want to encrypt every single field in a database. Here's Ken explaining why. Enjoy.
It's not intended to encrypt everything, because there's some things where you need the database to do a better job. If you said, give me every, I don't know, sales that happened within 5 kilometers of this coffee shop, the database would have to have the geolocation clear text, and it would have to have the clear text of everything around it within 5 kilometers, right? So geolocation is one of those tricky ones where it's really hard to do encrypted search in any meaningful way. So what this allows you to do is say just those fields that are sensitive. And you can just tag every single field in the entire database and say, these are all encrypted. But typically what people would do is, you know, customer number, record number, you know, invoice number, things like that.
Customer name, no date of birth, anything PII, right? I mean, you can still keep your geo-fenced, right, you know, your geo database there, but just encrypt the PII.
Right. And this is a hard conversation, but the thing about PII is, It's the link to who you are. If I said HIV status positive, HIV status negative, pregnant status positive, those are useless data unless they're tied to an actual person. Otherwise, they're just sort of free-floating values. If I said bank balance, $27,375,000, that in itself isn't really personally identified data. It's only when it's linked to something else. So there may be scenarios where you wouldn't encrypt financial values. You wouldn't encrypt something else. Most of the cases you would, but there's sometimes where you'd need clear text to do certain kinds of, you know, certs or filters or aggregation.
Yeah. So like less than, greater than, that sort of stuff, right? In the case of bank balances.
Yeah, and this is a common thing. That's right. And so like for banks, it's very common. They use this thing called tokenization, which is like—
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that, because as we've been talking about this, I'm like, it kind of sounds a bit like along the same lines as tokenization.
Right. And it's similar, but if you've actually talked to anybody who's implemented it, you know, they need to go to a bar and start drinking, because it's like, it's so painfully used. It's such a horrible experience. So you say, I've got sensitive data, I can't risk it. And you add tokenization. Well, now you've got sensitive data in two places. You've got the original, and you've got this conversion thing that says your social security number, which is whatever the raw value is, here's the token. And I'm going to send that token over here. But you've just duplicated your sensitive data, right? And now you deal with this third thing. So tokenization, it has its applications, and a lot of the banking world will use it. It's painful, though. So if you can make that, some of those kind of security properties just kind of work for free, like the way that a developer would normally, you know, run queries, that's a huge win. And so, and that is one of the nice benefits of this as well.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's been a hell of a journey, right, for MongoDB, where, you know, MongoDB has wound up with the headlines, the same as S3 buckets, the same as Elasticsearch. And this is what I believe led to you launching the managed service, the Atlas service, where, you know, you take care of all of that busy work of making the TLS work and, you know, setting reasonable defaults and all of that sort of stuff. I guess this feature is just an extension of that same trajectory, right? Of taking something that people were misusing and trying to make it better.
I think it's an intersection of things. I think there's some of that, but I think there's, and so certainly when there's some story about, some big breach, if it's just a random person on the internet who had an unsecured server, sometimes, yeah, we'll actually get a call from a customer, like a major Fortune 500, say, should we be concerned about this MongoDB thing? And it's like, well, no, that was just, you know, this was a configuration thing. By default, if you, right now today, and for the last like 5 or 6 years, if you install MongoDB out of the box, it's secure. It's not listening to the public interface. It's not accessible. The problem is if you kind of halfway go there, you open up all of the entire internet to be able to come and go, and you don't, so you sort of change the default configuration halfway, but you don't set a password, or you don't, you know, have a web service account or something like that, then yeah, that's a problem. But it would be a problem in any things. But the other kind of perfect storm that kind of led to this was customers that are like, look, this is hard. You know, we have banking customers that do $60 billion a day in transactions on MongoDB. They're like, we do not want to do, you know, we don't want to have teams of engineers whose only job is to do security patches and updates and, you know, OS updates and all this, you know, and keep these clusters running worldwide. Yes, we do that, but it's painful. It's hugely capex expensive.
So you've got major enterprise in that cloud service of yours, do you?
I'd say more than half the Fortune 500 run on MongoDB. Yeah. The biggest gaming platforms. I'm kind of hesitant because I'm not sure.
No, that's fine. You don't need to name them. They know who they are.
Let's just say it this way. If you have a mobile phone in your pocket, you're running MongoDB right now. Unless it's like it's obscure, like, you know, one-off thing. Banking, healthcare, the biggest retail, pharmacies, insurance, gaming, like, yes.
No. So, I mean, I got the idea. So let me ask my next question, which is, was this a feature, this new encryption feature, was this requested by those type of customers, or was this something that MongoDB did of its own volition? It sounds like a feature request to me. It sounds like something that a few customers said, can you build this for us?
It was an answer to a problem. And the problem was, we're using your systems for lines of business applications, for analytics. We like it. It's fast. It's great. Our compliance people, our risk people say, we can't, it's not you personally, it's not that we don't trust you, but we can't tolerate the risk profile of putting sensitive information in a third party, you or anyone else. So how could we kind of address that? And that's where we started. So this was a huge effort. I mean, this was one of the biggest engineering investments in the company. This was like 26 engineers over 2 years, you know, on every major platform. So it's query, security, the core engineering, you know, all these different language teams. I mean, it was a massive effort.
We did I imagine testing. This would come back a bit to compliance as well, right? So they're saying, no, we can't store Absolutely. That data there in case some engineer at you know, Amazon or whatever runs away with the disk.
Right. And some of the, and so, you know, I've kind of learned to be very patient and understanding, because some of the scenarios that people will contrive, it's like, it's probably pretty far-fetched, but you know, you still have to kind of go down that path.
Saying, I had a great chat with Haroon Mir recently on the show, where, you know, he gets asked often by his customers, like, if we have a canary on a network, can you hack us? And he's like, of course I can, but so can all your other providers. Like, why are we having this conversation? But right. You have to be patient, right?
Right. I mean, what I would say is that having looked in depth at the security engineering for the big three cloud providers, they are so heads and shoulders above 99% of the Fortune 500. And I'm talking about companies that have spent billions of dollars on security. If you're a little guy, it's really hard to keep up. I mean, it's just, you know, it's very hard to have the security maturity, the visibility, some of the stuff that they're doing with the big three, it just blows my mind. I mean, they're doing custom built TPMs. They're custom making hardware to assure, full supply chain security from boot up all the way to, you know, to the container side. I mean, that's.
Well, and they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff. Eventually with your own, you could rent like FPGA arrays, and like there is just like nutty stuff happening on the cloud side of things. But look, let's just go back to the encryption features here. How did you actually go about building this? Because, spoiler alert, I already know because we spoke about it before, but you implemented this as like, I mean, it's totally in line, right? Like, why don't you walk the listeners through how this actually works?
Sure. So in MongoDB, whether you're, whether there's an existing application or you're building something new, you start with a language, right? You're writing your application in some language. And so whatever that language is, there's a driver that connects, your programming framework to the database. What we did is we moved all that encryption logic into the drivers so that they do a lot of the hard lifting. You don't have to understand all the mechanics of the Amazon API for key management. You don't have to understand all these different block modes of encryption. You don't have 27 options of crypto settings and things. We wanted strong, secure defaults with, that were kind of opinionated. And also, we think we're pretty good at building distributed systems, but we're not like professional cryptography engineers. And so one of the things we did early on was like, look, we're going to reach out to people who are experts at breaking databases, at doing encrypted search, at understanding authenticated encryption. And like help have them come in, take a look at how we're thinking through the design as we build it up, run some audits, beat it up. And then once we actually have the shipping platforms, whether it's in Java or C# or whatever, really just beat the heck out of it and try to find any subtle vulnerability. Because as you know, it's a tiny coding error away from just complete undermining, an encrypted, data store. Really subtle coding errors can just, make the whole thing come tumbling down. So we were acutely aware of that, and we don't make any claims that this is, some be-all, end-all. We try to use boring, safe, conservative, like well-established, NIST-recognized, encryption standards and things like this. But the engineering challenge was making this work on, everything from an IBM mainframe to a brand new Windows server to kind of an ancient, 12, 13-year-old Red Hat server.
But see, this is a smart business decision, because if you can pull that off, you become the default, because developers are going to like you because they can take you with them between jobs, right?
Our number one goal was to make developers safer for these sensitive, confidential workloads, just make it easy to use. Because there's no shortage of technical options. You can go to GitHub right now and there's, thousands of encryption SDKs and plugins and modules and things, but they're all a pain. And in general, you can't search a database. So we wanted to kind of make a lot of those things go away, make it easy, built in, first-class citizen. And I think we've done a pretty good job. There's always room to improvement. And there's some new technology sort of always around the bend. Part of the problem, though, is when you work with, enterprise and federal clients and, big government institutions, things like that, they're not interested in bleeding edge. They don't want to see the latest, Fizinator 5000, crypto construction that just came out last week from some, academic journal. They want something that's like well understood, well recognized, well characterized and studied.
Production ready, boring, stable.
Yeah, boring.
So, Ken, if people want more information on this, what do they Google? Is it just MongoDB encryption, or have you got a brand for it, like a name for the feature?
Yes, the feature is called client-side field-level encryption. The entire cryptography framework is on GitHub. It's all Apache licensed. So, the whole thing's out there to take a look at, kick the tires. We've got tutorials, like, real short hello world, just like, 10 lines of code to get up and going to, whether it's in Go or Python or Node or whatever. So, yeah, we, love to have people, beat it up, try it out, see what they think, give us feedback.
All right. Well, I'm going to drop a link into the show notes for this podcast. Ken White, it has been a real pleasure to chat to you about this. It's something different, I mean, often we're talking about enterprise, detection, response, and prevention gear. This is just a genuinely interesting concept. And I wish you all the best with it. Cheers.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Ken White of MongoDB there talking about their client-side field-level encryption. Big thanks to Ken for that, and big thanks to MongoDB for being a snake oiler. I have dropped a link into this week's show notes for those of you who are interested in finding out some more about that. But yeah, I mean, even if you just Google for MongoDB client-side field-level encryption, You're going to get the info you need. You're not going to get a page, a website about banana distribution and logistics, are you? I think you're going to find the right stuff. Okay, it is on to the next snake oiler of today's podcast now. And our next guest is someone a lot of Risky Business listeners would remember hearing on the show before, Chris McNabb. He is the founder of AlphaSoc. He used to be an incident response lead at NCC Group. I think he came in via the ISEC path. And yeah, basically he realized a lot of the workflow he was doing on incident response gigs could be automated. So he turned that workflow into detection, basically. And so, I mean, really this whole thing started with domain analytics. So simple tricks like, you know, when there's a box on your network connecting regularly to a two-week-old domain, you know, beaconing to a two-week-old domain, you've probably got a problem there. I mean, basically, Chris has figured out how to pull all sorts of really high-quality signaling out of DNS data. So, I mean, that's one thing. But, like, as you're going to hear, it's, you know, it's broadened out quite a bit these days. It's more of a fully-fledged network traffic analysis engine. It's been broadened out to cover IP analytics. That's something we've spoken to Chris about on the show before. But now it does TLS and HTTP processing, user agent processing, Kerberos processing, and even some endpoint stuff. So yeah, Chris McNabb, very, very smart guy, joined me to talk about what AlphaSoc has been up to more recently. And here's what he had to say.
So years ago now, we started just solving and attacking the DNS analytics problem, you know, flagging beaconing behavior to young domains within, you know, suspicious TLDs and doing all kinds of other layered behavior analytics within DNS. That problem has been solved as far as we're concerned for a number of years now. And since then, we just extended, as you say, beyond DNS. So now we process IP telemetry, HTTP telemetry, TLS telemetry. We start to now correlate with DHCP. We're looking at Kerberos next, and really just we're going to slowly but surely work our way through, you know, the whole protocol stack, eventually ending up with maybe another, you know, year or so from now, endpoint telemetry. And then we can marry everything together and really help, you know, detection response teams identify, you know, infected systems and incidents with high fidelity and high utility. That's really the point of what we're trying to do.
So what is the output of your analysis engine actually look like, right? Because when it's DNS, okay, you know, this is a bad domain, right? That's one thing. Or this is a young domain, or there are indications that this domain is bad. And then that's an indication that you would then feed onwards, upwards into a seam. But, yes, you know, you're broadening it out. Is it still the same idea that this is, and this is where it gets really confusing, right? Because you've got your collection agents like Zeek, right? Now you've got this analytics engine that you're making, and then you've got your seam. You're not trying, yes, to replace the collection. You're not trying to replace the seam. You're trying to sit somewhere in the middle, aren't you?
Yeah. And we essentially, a good way of thinking of it is that we automate the work that a tier two, tier three SOC analyst would be doing. So the engine flags, like I said, things like beaconing to a young domain within a suspicious TLD, or maybe on the HTTP side, it will flag, you know, a weird post operation to an odd destination, maybe combined within the same few minutes with like an IP lookup or some other signals. So really what we are doing is automating that manual work. The way that we do that, absolutely, we take the telemetry that's collected through you know, Zeek, Corelight, Suricata, Splunk, wherever you have the telemetry or your data lake. We process that telemetry, and then we kick that out in natively. It uses a JSON format, but we can also use CEF. We can ship stuff over syslog into your SIM. And essentially, we're just then generating high fidelity alerts, such as, you know, oh, by the way, this machine is now beaconing to this wacky destination that has a positive virus total score and a lot of other interesting signals that you might want to
that's see. That's generally the sort of thing you want to know about. I'll grant you that. That's you know, you don't need your machine learning to tune that one out.
Right. Yeah. Precisely. So. But a lot of other detection response analytics tools within the market today, they're very dependent on threat feeds and indicator lists to provide any kind of context or you know, generate alerts. So there are we've just found I've found personally through doing incident response and forensics and SOC work now for years I've just found that there are, you know, large blind spots and gaps with indicator lists and feeds. So you have to then apply this kind of behavioral layering, which actually is a tricky problem to solve, because a lot of the SIMs and a lot of the systems, if not all of them, as far as I'm concerned, that are out there today that customers and enterprises are using, are reliant on, you know, threat feeds and indicator lists. So they're a little bit brittle, which is why you might want to use a system like ours.
So, you know, if someone wanted to just get going and trial this thing, say they don't have a full SIEM setup, like how would you actually go about just using the AlphaSock engine to, you know, give you an output, you know, some of these indicators? What would be the bare bones way you'd set this up?
Yeah, great question. So we have, from a bare bones perspective, we have an agent called NFR, which is Network Flight Recorder. That was a trademark that Checkpoint abandoned in 2005.
Did you pick up the old NFR trademark? How did you swing that?
Yeah. Checkpoint abandoned the trademark in 2005.
Who haven't been in security for way too long, Network Flight Recorder is the name of basically one of the first ever network IDSs, yeah. Right? So
yeah.
Was Marcus Ranham involved in that one? I think he was, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So Marcus then sold the business, I believe, to Checkpoint in 1999, and then they kind of rolled it into their product line, and then, you know, end of life.
That's awesome. So, okay. Anyway, sorry, that was a tangent, but you have Network Flight Recorder. Now, this is a local collection agent, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so from the start for the listeners, if you go to github.com/alphasock/NFR, it's just open source. It's in GitHub. You pull it down. It runs, you know, it's just an agent, a local agent, as you say, that runs, you know, for, you know, Windows, Linux, Mac. NFR can then pick up data in a number of ways and ship it to us. So one of the ways that some users set it up is just as a sniffer. So it's just using libpcap and just sniffing data locally. So it can run as a sensor. It can also run as an agent to pick up log files. So if you have, let's say, Zeek, or Suricata output, like a Zeek, like a DNS.log, con.log, or any kind of output like that, you can monitor those files with NFR and then ship them to our API for scoring. And then the alerts will make their way back down through NFR, down to file, or you can ship them over syslog, or however you want to ship them from NFR, as I said, in like a, you know, JSON or CEF format. And you can, of course, just look at the raw JSON and use it. We do then have, because we run the service as a cloud service for the majority of our customers and users, we do then have a web console. So almost like asynchronously, you would ship the telemetry to us using NFR locally, you know, within your environment. You'd set that up and get that shipping the telemetry to the AlphaSock analytics engine. And then we can set you up with a web console UI element so that you can then interact with the material in a much
maybe you know, maybe in 20 way. Years when they let the trademark expire, you can call it Backstory.
Precisely. So that's the way that you can do it, kind of cheaply and cheerfully. If you do have Splunk, our preferred option is to just drop our Splunk app into your environment and set that up, which is like a 2 or 3 minute exercise, which then just does all of the above natively within Splunk. So that's kind of probably 70% of our customers are Splunk users.
I love it that Splunk actually has this really vibrant marketplaces full of apps that whose sole goal is to make Splunk actually usable.
Right, absolutely.
What the fuck are you doing, you know?
Well, it's a platform, right?
Yeah. So, you know, of these areas that you've expanded into, we're talking about TLS processing, user agent processing, and, you know, you're looking at Kerberos events. I believe OS queries are coming up there as well for, you know, endpoint stuff. Like, what's yielding the most interesting results from your perspective when you start feeding this stuff into your analytics engine?
DNS has always been great for us just because of the depth of processing that we have there and that we've extended over, you know, 6-7 years now. So if you take, let's say, you know, beaconing to a young domain within a suspicious TLD that's unique to a customer environment, for a competing or rival product to produce that result would require like a big refactor of their code and, you know, turning it on its head turning it upside down, because it's not a lot of these other tools in order to even flag young domains. they are dependent on newly observed domain feeds and material coming in order to make those decisions. So one of the DNS has always been great for us and provides the biggest bang for the buck. So if of any of the telemetry types, you know, you have to pick one to go with, DNS for sure will give you the biggest bang for the buck.
This is kind of reminds me of the whole concept of putting the rocks in the jar. And the jar's full, but then you can pour the smaller rocks into the jar and then, you know, smaller and smaller until you're down to sand and then dust. And it sounds like what you're saying is DNS are the DNS analytics that represent the big rocks.
Yeah, and one of my favorite exercises, if you look at our Twitter account, you know, AlphaSock on Twitter, one of the things that I'm always doing is looking at live indicators and research that malware researchers are doing around, you know, TrickBot and TA505 and APT33 and these other groups. And real time, I'm then throwing all those indicators into the analytics stack to see whether the engine natively out of the box, you know, on the fly, would actually generate alerts and flag those campaigns. And consistently, the system, you know, just using, you know, host names and DNS telemetry, the system is capable of flagging, you know, sophisticated, you know, threat groups and actors.
And this is the reason that we love having you back, Chris, is because you've actually done something that works. That's not rocket science. It doesn't use machine learning. It doesn't have tigers in its marketing, but it actually works. And it's just, you know, based on the sort of workflow you do when you're trying to, as a human operator, figure out if a domain is good or bad, because it's not that fucking hard, is it?
No, exactly. And we have one of the newer classifiers we have in the stack is imposter detection. So we do have a bit of ML and measurements that we're doing in terms of.
Yeah, but I'm guessing you catch the bulk of it with the simple stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
But the imposter detection, for example, will then flag, you know, trademarks and labels within much larger strings. So if then an actor sets up, you know, SharePoint-secure.com, the engine will then recognize that as a likely imposter. Then also maybe it's a young domain, will then upgrade it again. If it's maybe doing some beaconing or if the pattern is weird or unique to a customer, will then upgrade it further. So we just practically, Patrick, you know, we just get great results with the stack that we have in place. Now that we have the TLS and the HTTP processing, we can do a lot more interesting stuff with identifying outliers, you know, JAR3 and SSL certificate hashes that are maybe unique or we haven't seen before or aren't ubiquitous to all of the, you know, the environments that we're protecting.
All right, Chris McNabb, I'll drop some links into the show notes. Basically, you can self-provision a key if you want to get going with this and give it a go. And I would heartily recommend you do, because why on earth wouldn't you? Very easy to set up, very easy to get going with. AlphaSock, and I got to say, I have never seen a vendor or dealt with a vendor that has as good documentation as you, Chris. And I know that you would have put a lot of work into that, and it's all right there on the GitHub. Thank you so much for joining us on the show to update us on where you're at, and we'll look forward to doing it again probably next year.
Of course. Thanks, Patrick.
That was Chris McNabb there. Big thanks to him for that. You can check out AlphaSock at alphasock.com, spelled, of course, alphasoc.com. Okay, it is time for our final Snake Oilers segment for the day now, and we are talking to Paul McCarty of SecureStack. SecureStack is an Australia-based company. Twice a year, the Australian Information Security Industry Body, AustCyber, nominates one of the companies it works with to participate in a Snake Oilers podcast. And yeah, this time they nominated SecureStack. And basically the idea behind SecureStack is to help developers spin up secure by default cloud resources and to give them the ability to manage all of those cloud resources as their, you know, developments and as their businesses scale. Paul McCarty joined me for this interview and started off by telling me who this is for. And this is SecureStack is apparently for developers. And yeah, he started off by telling me what it is developers are currently doing that they're trying to put a stop to. Here's what he had to say.
Traditionally, in my experience, what they're doing is they're going on building something, a special snowflake on the spot that they need right now and right then. It doesn't have any standardization, doesn't have any repeatability. It's not like that last one they built. So first and foremost, we give them the ability to build the same secure thing, that same secure unit every single time, plus all the additional security benefits and scalability benefits we put on top of that.
Okay. So when you talk about, you know, building secure units, what does that look like? Is that, you know, doing some basic host hardening? Like, talk us through what you would do to an individual, you know, thing.
We have an idea in at SecureStack of a abstracted workload. We call it a cloud builder product. And that cloud builder product includes first a hardened operating system, either a Linux or a Windows hardened operating system. We then have an integration layer that applies security controls and agents, applications, user access to those instances. Then we wrap around that workload any cloud native security that you need to be included, security groups, IAM, so on and so forth. And that then abstracted workload, you can deploy that anywhere you want to.
So what are people typically using this for, right? What's the problem that they're solving with SecureStack?
Developers, their metric of success is how quickly they can deploy features, right? Their metric of success is not how scalable or secure the things that they're delivering are, right? And that's what I really wanted to address with SecureStack. I wanted to build a platform that said, hey, listen, we can give you scalability, we can give you security, and we can give it to you in a very easy to consume way.
So, I mean, you talk about stopping sprawl, right? But, you know, what you've mostly told me now is that, you know, you can make these things reproducible and scalable, which tells me that you can spin up basically limitless instances of whatever. Like, how is that helping with sprawl?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, part of sprawl is the diff between the different units, right? So sprawl is effectively how I manage all these instances across a disparate environment, maybe GCP and AWS. If they're all, you know, 1% difference across thousands of instances, that's a lot of diff. And what we do first and foremost is we make sure that every single one of those instances looks the same, is repeatable, and you can then manage security and scalability across those the same. And that's an important thing, right? When they all look the same and they have our integration layer inside of them, we can then apply security controls across all of them in the same manner.
So when you say your integration layer, you know, what is it?
It's a combination of endpoint configuration management, as well as some really, really deep API work that we've done with the CloudWatch providers. And also for that matter, VMware and OpenStack too as well.
So essentially what you're talking about is this is an agent that you can deploy on these workloads and use that agent to manage them through your console. I mean, essentially that's the product there.
Well, we do have an agent, but we can actually run an agentless mode too as well.
Yeah.
So for example, like some of our early customers in the States bought us because they had large auto-scaling environments, right? Deploying an agent in those environments isn't necessarily realistic, right? So what we did early on is we wanted to say, we want to be able to apply our technology for those auto-scaling environments, just like we can for the other type of environments, right? So we support an agent, but we can run agentless as well.
And what's the sort of stuff that you can do with an agent that you can't do agentless in your case? Because I'd imagine be some stuff you're just not going to be able to do.
Yeah, it's the typical stuff. So it's file integrity monitoring, IDS, IPS, the usual kind of stuff. But for example, there's a bunch of things that we used to do using the agent that we no longer do. So as we've moved towards a more API-centric model at SecureStack, a lot of the things we used to do with the agent, we don't do anymore. So for example, user access, we actually now create that through our native API calls rather than using the agent.
Yeah. I mean, look, it makes a lot of sense to have a blend of the two, right? And I'm guessing that, what does the customer get? They're going to get some sort of control panel. I mean, you know, we're seeing these new businesses like yours pop up and it's basically cPanel for 2020. Don't take that the wrong way because, we know it's not going to be as awful as cPanel. But I mean, that's essentially where companies like yours are sitting, isn't it? You know, the new cPanel.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't speak to those kind of companies. We're a lot more than that. So we have deep API integration into the cloud providers and the private cloud providers, like I said, VMware and OpenStack. But beyond that, we have technology, including, host-based firewall and security groups that we can manage from the same policy built into our platform too as well. So there's a lot more there than just cPanel.
So it's not just about spinning up the resources. It's about having some sort of control and observability onto them as well.
God, no. Because every time we show up at a customer, they've got, sure, we address their greenfield, but they also have thousands and thousands of brownfield objects, and we need to be able to manage those
well, how do you do that, right? When a customer calls you in and they've already got an environment that's quite big. I mean, you know, what does it look like trying to get you into that environment? Do you just get provisioned with some fairly powerful access keys and then, you know, your software goes and herds all of these instances and analyzes them somehow? I mean, how do you even start?
No, that's actually not how we usually start. That's usually how we end up. So after we've built trust with a customer, that's where we end up. But no, we start out by actually getting read-only access to the keys. So we use, for example, on AWS, we use the security audit policy. And basically what we do is we go and scan the instances and the AWS accounts that are involved and find security gaps, right? We identify those security gaps, and then we've got
logic. What sort of security gaps do you mean?
So, for example, if basically every web application or every application is essentially it's the components therein, right? So it's DNS, it's servers, it's IAM, it's all kinds of stuff, right? So the great thing about us having visibility at the cloud native layer as well as at the operating system endpoint layer is that we can see all of that stuff, right? So we can see, for example, hey, you know, firewall wide open on the endpoint, but hey, a security group is blocking us. Let's now match the firewall on the endpoint to the security group. Or IAM. Somebody stuck a bunch of asterisks in the IAM policy. Let's address that. What is the real requirements for this particular web application, right? So that's one of the great things about having that visibility at the cloud native layer, which is very unique, right? Because most applications kind of concentrate on either endpoint management or cloud native, the CSPM kind of stuff. We do both.
Okay, that makes sense. And, where is this stuff proving popular? I mean, we spoke a little bit before we hit record and, you were telling me that this is popular in the sort of, scaling and medium-sized business.
Yeah, it is. We're finding a lot of success with scale-ups in larger startups. Organizations that are developer-driven, like one of our customers, for example, has 40 developers and zero ops. Zero security people, right? This is common. This is common for startups and scale-ups. So for those organizations,
I wouldn't necessarily say that that's a good thing.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but that's the reality, right? Yeah. The reality is they have no ops people. They have no security people. So they have two or three developers that have taken over the AWS account, and they're just trying to get by, right? So what we do is we give them this ability to embed security across a disparate number of services in AWS and inside of their compute environment really easily, really, really easily.
Paul McCarty, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Biz to have a bit of a chat about what you're doing over there at SecureStack.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me.
That was Paul McCarty of SecureStack there. Big thanks to him for that. You can check them out at securestack.com. There are links to everything we talked about in the show notes for this podcast. That is it for part one of this edition of Snake Oilers. I'll be back next week with a weekly news edition of the podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.